KABC Talk Radio 790 AM. This is the Victory Session. Stephen K. Bannon. We are very honored to have with us this evening Spengler. That is David Goldman, who writes the Spengler column for Asia Times Online, which has been one of my favorite reads for many years. He is now out with a new book, How Civilizations Die. David Goldman, welcome to the Victory Sessions.
Thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate it.
Listen, let's start first with your background and with the Spengler column, which Spengler is obviously a play on Decline of the West. How did you come to write that? Why Asia Times Online? And what's been the arc of those columns over the last couple of years?
Asia Times Online was edited by a guy I knew from National Security Council in the old first Reagan administration, who asked me to write a couple of things. And back in the late 90s, Steve, I was running research groups on Wall Street for Credit Suisse, later for Bank of America, and I became, let's say, deeply alarmed with the spread of suicidal irrationality in the Muslim world. I think that's the right word for it. And I also became alarmed at what I consider to be the good-hearted naivete on the part of the George W. Bush administration. I like our former president. I'm a rock-red Republican, but I believe that the idea that we could go in and fix Arab countries and Muslim countries otherwise and turn them into pro-American democracy through nation building was a dangerous delusion.
And by the way, and you said this, David, you said this back in early 2000. I mean, this is now with the retreat, you know, with our strategic defeat being announced this past week, where we're leaving Iraq, and with all the guys thrown in the towel on nation building, you know, 9 years later, it's come to fruition that you were correct.
Well, let me put it this way. I think that Obama's turn, tail, and run approach in Iraq is the wrong thing to do. I'm all for deploying American troops and, if necessary, sacrificing American lives as well as treasure if it directly impacts the security of the United States. I don't think we can fix countries which come from a religious and political system which is so antithetical to the way we work that they'll never quite happen. I heard a senior Israeli official put it really well. He said it's like a patient rejecting a heart transplant. Yep. You can't put a democratic heart into an Arab body because the patient will reject it. And if that wasn't going to be the case, if we were focused on the wrong things, what other things were we going to be missing? And the main thing I think we've missed is we've allowed the power of Iran to grow and, prospectively, their chance to acquire nuclear weapons. And that, I think, should alarm every one of us, because if a country like Iran gets nuclear weapons, number one, they are suicidal enough to use them, and number two, they're suicidal enough to use them in American cities.
One thing I want to get on the table, because you've been criticized, or some observations have been made, particularly from the left, is that you're not anti-Arab. I want you to go back and say the antithetical. You believe that the Judeo-Christian West, Western civilizations, has a few basic tenets to it that are the foundation of that civilization. And those are, you know, not compatible with, oftentimes, with Arab civilization. Is that correct?
Well, Steve, absolutely. As an observant Jew, I, of course, bring my own perspective to bear. But standing apart from my own religious beliefs, success in the modern world comes from empowerment of the individual, the kind of emphasis on freedom and rights that allows talent to bubble up from the bottom of society, allows a Steve Jobs to become a head of a company with a bigger market cap than Exxon, allows poor kids to become president, allows people to pursue their dreams and thereby contribute to society. That idea of individual empowerment, of individual rights, comes from the biblical idea of covenant. Muslim society is a top-down society, not a bottom-up society, and that's why the Muslim countries have been catastrophic failures at adapting to the modern world.
That's why they've had this, you know, they really haven't had what we call their enlightenment. There's this modernity is a, seems like they can't break through modernity. And one of the reasons they haven't had an enlightenment, so to speak, like the West had, correct?
There's nothing to enlighten. Muslim society, as we observe it, is going directly from infancy to senility without passing through adulthood. That is, you have countries like Iran and Turkey, Algeria, Tunisia, and a number of others, that have gone within one generation from the kind of traditional society where everybody lives on the farm and everyone has seven kids to modernity where families have one or two children and they breed like the Europeans about to disappear. No one has ever in the history of demographics gone from having seven kids per family to one or two kids per family in a single generation. It's unheard of, yet that's exactly what we're seeing in Muslim countries. And what it means as a matter of arithmetic is the economic and political breakdown of Iran, Turkey, and a number of other countries, which means we face not the prospect of stable enemies or stable friends, but a chaotic mess for the next generation that we're going to have to come to terms with.
Well, let's segue to the book. The book is How Civilizations Die, and you bring up a concept of the fifth horseman of the apocalypse, the original four horsemen being what? War, famine, death, and pestilence. Yeah. And you basically have laid out the new fifth horseman, which you say is lack of faith, and that is the underpinning of really a population, potential population implosion, particularly in Western Europe, Japan, potentially the United States. And you say that that is the biggest challenge of the 21st century is going to be the basically the erasing of certain parts of our civilization.
And I want to emphasize, Steve, that this is not original to me. There is now a consensus on the part of the academic sociologists that people who lose religious faith stop having children. There have been a number of books out by panicked liberal sociologists saying religious people will take over the world by default because they're the only ones who will turn up for history. The people of faith of Europe have the same kind of big families that people of faith do in the United States. There just aren't that many of them. And what we see in a country like Iran, for example, where we've gone, as I said, from seven kids per family to one or two, is a collapse of Muslim faith. It's very much like the Soviet Union. When we turned over the rock in 1989, we found there weren't any communists in the Soviet Union except for the fanatics in charge of the Central Committee. And the same is true in Iran. The fanatics who run that country face a population which, by and large, has fallen away from faith, and their desperation, their apocalyptic sense, is that if they don't use their power very quickly and decisively, they're likely to lose it.
What you basically are saying that the West is going through really willed self-extinction. Can you explain that?
What we see in countries that have lost their faith, particularly Western Europe or places like Quebec, or even the part of the American population which is either secular or very lightly affiliated in a religious way, is that people would simply rather have bigger cars, bigger houses, and nicer vacations than to bother to raise children. And we only have seen this a few times in recorded history. We saw the Greek world after the time of Alexander the Great stop raising daughters so that their population collapsed. The reason Rome crushed Greece was that there simply weren't enough people to put in the field against them. And we saw it in the decline of Rome, where the Romans famously exposed or strangled their children so they could go on having fun. A hedonistic society with no sense of its future and no sense of a spiritual future in particular simply doesn't bother to raise children. And my argument is that the great civilizations of history die not because they chopped down too many trees or somebody happened to catch the wrong kind of virus, but because they will themselves out of existence. Small civilizations can die for all kinds of reasons. Big civilizations only destroy themselves.
Let me, the seventh, that my, this is KBC 790 AM, Los Angeles, California, talk radio, the Victory Session, Stephen K. Bannon. My guest this segment is David Goldman, author of How Civilizations Die, new book out from Regnery, and the columnist Spengler on Asia Times Online. David, how the seventh billionth person in the world is supposedly born, I think, in the next 24 hours, somewhere in India. And I just saw the other day where there's a projection that there's going to be 10 billion by 2050 and 15 billion by, you know, 2100. How does that demographic analysis, because your book is really, you know, demography as destiny or faith underlying demography is destiny. How does that, you're saying that certain parts of the world are going to implode population-wise. Are you also agreeing that that we're going to have a lot more people in the world?
No, I don't believe that, Steve. If you go to the United Nations Population Prospects website, which is a wonderful site, it's open to the public and you can put in your own assumptions, they have low, middle, and high scenarios. During the last 20 years, population growth rates in almost every country in the world have fallen into the low set of estimates of the demographers because as people become educated, as they leave traditional society, they stop having the 8 or 10 kids that farmers always do when they don't know how to read the back of a package of contraceptive tablets. Traditional society always has tons of kids. That's what people do. But as people become urbanized, it changes. And we have the biggest wave of urbanization ever in world history. Now, if you look at the low scenario on the United Nations website, it shows a substantial decline in population before the end of the century. The populations of Western Europe, of Eastern Europe, of most of East Asia will start declining very rapidly. A country like Mexico, which 30 years ago had typically had families of five or yeah. six, is now barely at break even.
In fact, I just talked at a big Korean gathering of young Korean American leaders last Saturday at USC, and this whole discussion was up about how Korean women are. There's a whole issue about Korean and Korean American women not having the number of kids they used to have. My guest is David Goldman. This is the Victory Sessions. We're going to be back in 1 minute to continue this conversation. KBC 790 AM Talk Radio, Los Angeles, California. This is Stephen K. Bannon, the Victory Sessions, 790 AM Talk Radio, Los Angeles, California, the capital of the Pacific. My guest is David Goldman, the columnist Spengler in Asia Times Online, which is a must-read for all our listeners out there, and the author of a shocking new book, How Civilizations Die. David, walk through your basic scenario for the United States over the next decade. I mean, what do you think, and then beyond, because you're fairly pessimistic in parts of that, and other parts like the evangelical community, you're not. Can you explain to my listeners or our listeners exactly what your thesis is?
Well, number one, Steve, the United States is not going to be replaced as a world power by anybody. The worst you can say about us is that we're the leper with the most fingers. We're the only industrial country, among the large ones anyway, that will have more people in the workforce in 2050 than we have now. Europe and Japan will be down by a quarter and a third, respectively. So you don't want to buy.
By the way, that has shocking consequences to society. Has any society ever gone through that where they're losing a third of their working population in less than, what, 20 or 30 years?
No, this has never occurred. You wonder why there's a European economic crisis going on now. Who would buy a 30-year bond from Italy? They're going to have 30 or 40% fewer taxpayers out there to pay taxes, to pay the interest in 30 years. So Italy is going bust one way or the other. That's why you have a European financial crisis, ultimately. Their entitlements will crush them. They're a problem here. We have an aging population, but we at least have a chance to fix our problems. Europe is probably past the point of no return. So that's
why do you say Europe? By the way, I've traveled extensively through Europe when I sold one of my companies there and spent a lot of time in France and a lot of time in Italy. And I will tell you, you notice a real lack of energy. Particularly after you get outside the cities, the towns look like they're dying. The population's old. It's like in Japan when they had the tsunami. These towns outside of Tokyo and the major cities, Paris, Milan, Rome, you don't see the energy, and they look they're very decrepit. They look like infrastructure's falling apart. You just don't feel any energy. Is that what you're talking about? That that these guys are the beginning stages of these population implosions?
Well, each of the European countries decided sometime in the last 500 years that they were God's choice of representative on Earth, and they fought a set of world wars starting in the 17th century over that proposition. They fought each other into apathy and enervation. So exactly what you see is just a lack of interest in being there on the part of most of Europe. People resign themselves to their quiet little pleasures, which don't seem to include raising children. So economically, Europe is toast. Japan is going in the same direction. China's a great country, but they also have a declining population, so no one's going to replace the United States. Secondly, the United States is two countries. We have, for example, evangelical Protestants who have 2.5 or 3 kids per family, and we have the Episcopalians who have 1.2. We've got the Reformed Jews who've got the lowest fertility rate of any identifiable group in the United States, 1 child per family, and we have the Orthodox who have anywhere from 3 to 7, depending on the current. So we have part of the American population which is doing very well, very enthusiastic, deeply faithful, patriotic, and energetic. We have other parts of the population which are much more like Europe. So we're really a split picture, and the question we have in the United States is which side of America is going to prevail. And I wrote my book, How Civilizations Die, in the hope of holding up a mirror to Americans, because I care about what happens to America a lot more than what happens to anybody else, and say, there but for the grace of God go we. Let's hope that we don't emulate the Europeans and others, that we continue to be exceptional Americans.
What, for policymakers, this book is a very deep book about demographics. For policymakers today, what are there a set of policies, or do you really think it just gets back to individuals' belief in God, underlying faith, in a set of beliefs that comes off of that? Or do you think there's actual policies that, that policymakers can, like in China, they have the one-child policy, which clearly is going to have a dramatic effect upon these guys. In the United States, is there a set of policy prescriptions that can help us avoid being a Europe?
I didn't address this in detail in How Civilizations Die, which is more about foreign policy. My view is that subsidies to families are a good thing. They help at the margin, and we should have a bigger personal income tax credit for children, probably lower Social Security deductions for people with families, because they're, after all, producing future taxpayers who will contribute to the system in the future. There are things we could do to make things easier for people, but the fact is, people who want children don't want them because it's easy to have kids. No matter how you look at it, you know, raising a child, according to the government statistics, cost you $400,000 even before college per child. So you do it out of love, not out of convenience. There's no way you can pay people enough to make the difference.
The in this election cycle coming up, our foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, it looks like we're getting ready to have a strategic retreat from Afghanistan. I think for the first time in history, we had the Secretary of State, the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs visit Pakistan, and we had Eli Lake on here 2 weeks ago saying how we're at war with certain elements in the power structure of Pakistan. What is your broad stroke view of what's going to happen in that whole region over the next couple of years?
No matter what we do, we're going to have chaos. The Arab Spring, as I've said before in my columns, many people have said, was a response to the fact that the Arab world, the non-oil-producing Arab world, is in a state of economic breakdown. Egypt's a country which has 80 million people, half of them can't read, 60% of them are living on the farm, but they still import half their food, half their caloric consumption. I'd say they're in serious trouble. With the rise in world food prices, the subsidies didn't quite make it. Food prices are up, according to the Egyptian newspapers, by 80% over the last year. And for people who barely have enough calories to make it through the day, that's pretty bad. So we're not going to stabilize Egypt. We're not going to stabilize a place like Iran, which is painfully aware that it has one generation to make its play, and a country like Pakistan, where people live on a dollar a day, and you have 50% illiteracy and a large number of warring tribes and religious sects, whatever we do, we're going to come out with a chaotic mess. And the question is, will it be chaos that favors us or hurts us? If the Iranians exploit the chaos, get control of Iraqi and perhaps even Saudi oil reserves, and develop nuclear weapons, then we have a problem of an entirely different magnitude. If the Iranians have nuclear weapons, it means they can invade their neighbors under the threat of nuclear response should we go in and try to push them out. They become immune to the normal kind of deterrence. That's why I think the single most important policy issue for Republican candidates is to say clearly that they will do whatever is necessary, including as much use of force as is required to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
How can, by the way, how can the Republicans, and I'm a conservative, but how can Republicans have any credibility when both Iraq and Afghanistan, which are two wars that started under our management, right? The whole nation went to war, but it was a Republican administration. Both wars are ending in military victories, or somewhat military, total military victory in Iraq and a partial one in Afghanistan, but strategic defeat. How does the Republican Party have credibility to talk about taking the nation into another war?
Well, that's exactly the problem we've got, Steve, and that's why for the last 10 years I've stepped on a lot of toes in the Republican Party and made myself unpopular by saying we will lose credibility if we pursue a policy, spend $1 trillion of treasure, 4,000 lives, 40,000 wounded, the American people will have enough. I think what Republican candidates can do and what the American people will applaud is to say we're not going to have another nation-building exercise, another occupation army, but we will use American force, particularly from the air, subversion, and so forth, to stop Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. We don't have to invade them. We just have to decapitate their leadership.
Listen, I think the lesson, you know, Gaddafi and Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, the lesson is without nukes, at the end of the day, we'll get them. And so that's why I think it's very important that the mullahs in Iran not get nukes. And if the American leadership doesn't get that, then we're in deep trouble. With the few minutes we've got, David, the Spengler column, Asia Times Online, it's a must read.
Well, talk to
us about Panetta went from the meetings in Pakistan to Asia, and there's a new talk. We had Dr. Aaron Friedberg here 2 weeks ago with his new book, and he was named that date as Mitt Romney's advisor. The new military and new conference seems to me the new confrontational attitude in China or around China by the United States. How do you view that?
China can either be a friendly rival or an unfriendly rival. I don't believe China wants to replace us as the hegemonic power in the world. They've never shown that much interest outside areas related to their immediate border.
Right.
But when the United States undergoes a strategic withdrawal and announces that it's committing a strategic withdrawal, it's letting the world get into much more dangerous condition, and the Chinese, as a matter of self-interest, will try to move into the vacuum. Take Pakistan, for example. A lot of people are saying, oh, look at China, they're moving into Pakistan, they want to take the place over. If we don't coddle the Pakistanis, they'll fall into the hands of the Chinese. Not true. The Chinese are extremely worried about the Pakistanis because they've got 100 million Muslims in their country, and they have terrorists that are being trained by Pakistani intelligence, the same people who organized the attack on our embassy in Kabul a couple of months ago.
Those guys
are also training terrorists who are operating in China. The Chinese
a 24-hour attack that made the page 20 in the New York Times. Listen, David, we've got to go. We're going to have you back. My guest has been David Goldman.
Thank you very much.
He's got a must-read column, Spengler, in Asia Times Online, and also the author of the new book, How Civilizations Die, another great book from Regnery. So please pick it up. David Goldman, thank you very much for being on the Victory Sessions.
Thank you so much, Steve.
This is Stephen K. Bannon, the Victory Sessions, 790 AM, Talk Radio, Los Angeles, California, the capital of the Pacific. My guest is David Goldman, the columnist Spengler in Asia Times Online, which is a must-read for all our listeners out there, and the author of a shocking new book, How Civilizations Die. David, walk through your basic scenario for the United States over the next decade. I mean, what do you think, and then beyond, because you're fairly pessimistic in parts of that, in other parts like the evangelical community, you're not. Can you explain to my listeners or our listeners exactly what your thesis is?
Well, number one, Steve, the United States is not going to be replaced as a world power by anybody. The worst you can say about us is that we're the leper with the most fingers. We're the only industrial country, among the large ones anyway, that will have more people in the workforce in 2050 than we have now. Europe and Japan will be down by a quarter and a third, respectively. So you don't want to buy.
By the way, that has shocking consequences to society. Has any society ever gone through that, where they're losing a third of their working population in less than, what, 20 or 30 years?
No, this has never occurred. You wonder why there's a European economic crisis going on now. Who would buy a 30-year bond from Italy? They're going to have 30 or 40% fewer taxpayers out there to pay taxes, to pay the interest in 30 years. So Italy is going bust one way or the other. That's why you have a European financial crisis, ultimately. Their entitlements will crush them. They're a problem here. We have an aging population, but we at least have a chance to fix our problems. Europe is probably past the point of no return. So that's
why do you say Europe? By the way, I've traveled extensively through Europe when I sold one of my companies there and spent a lot of time in France and a lot of time in Italy. And I will tell you, you notice a real lack of energy. Particularly after you get outside the cities, the towns look like they're dying. The population's old. It's like in Japan when they had the tsunami. These towns outside of Tokyo and the major cities, Paris, Milan, Rome, you don't see the energy, and they look, you know, they're very decrepit. They look like infrastructure's falling apart. You just don't feel any energy. Is that what you're talking about? That these guys are the beginning stages of these population implosions?
Well, each of the European countries decided sometime in the last 500 years that they were God's choice of representative on Earth, and they fought a set of world wars starting in the 17th century over that proposition. They fought each other into apathy and enervation. So exactly what you see is just a lack of interest in being there on the part of most of Europe. People resign themselves to their quiet little pleasures, which don't seem to include raising children. So economically, Europe is toast. Japan is going in the same direction. China's a great country, but they also have a declining population, so no one's going to replace the United States. Secondly, the United States is two countries. We have, for example, evangelical Protestants who have 2.5 or 3 kids per family, and we have the Episcopalians who have 1.2. We've got the Reformed Jews, who've got the lowest fertility rate of any identifiable group of the United States, one child per family. And we have the Orthodox, who have anywhere from, you know, 3 to 7, depending on the current. So we have part of the American population which is doing very well, very enthusiastic, deeply faithful, patriotic, and energetic. We have other parts of the population which are much more like Europe. So we're really a split picture, and the question we have in the United States is which side of America is going to prevail. And I wrote my book, How Civilizations Die, in the hope of holding up a mirror to Americans, because I care about what happens to America a lot more than what happens to anybody else, and say, there but for the grace of God go we. Let's hope that we don't emulate the Europeans and others, that we continue to be exceptional Americans.
What for policymakers? This book is a very deep book about demographics. For policymakers today, what are there a set of policies, or do you really think it just gets back to individuals' belief in God, underlying faith, in a set of beliefs that comes off of that? Or do you think there's actual policies that policymakers can, like in China, they have the one child policy, which clearly is going to have a dramatic effect upon these guys. In the United States, is there a set of policy prescriptions that can help us avoid being a Europe?
I didn't address this in detail in How Civilizations Die, which is more about foreign policy. My view is that subsidies to families are a good thing. They help at the margin, and we should have a bigger personal income tax credit for children, probably lower Social Security deductions for people with families, because they're, after all, producing future taxpayers who will contribute to the system in the future. There are things we could do to make things easier for people, but the fact is, people who want children don't want them because it's easy to have kids. No matter how you look at it, you know, raising a child, according to the government statistics, costs you $400,000 even before college per child. So you do it out of love, not out of convenience. There's no way you can pay people enough to make the difference.
In this election cycle coming up, our foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, it looks like we're getting ready to have a strategic retreat from Afghanistan. I think for the first time in history, we had the Secretary of State, the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs visit Pakistan, and we had Eli Lake on here 2 weeks ago saying how we're at war with certain elements in the power structure of Pakistan. What is your broad stroke view of what's going to happen in that whole region over the next couple of years?
No matter what we do, we're going to have chaos. The Arab Spring, as I've said before in my columns, many people have said, was a response to the fact that the Arab world, the non-oil-producing Arab world, is in a state of economic breakdown. Egypt's a country which has 80 million people, half of them can't read, 60% of them are living on the farm, but they still import half their food, half their caloric consumption. I'd say they're in serious trouble. With the rise in world food prices, the subsidies didn't quite make it. Food prices are up, according to the Egyptian newspapers, by 80% over the last year. And for people who barely have enough calories to make it through the day, that's pretty bad. So we're not going to stabilize Egypt. We're not going to stabilize a place like Iran, which is painfully aware that it has one generation to make its play, and a country like Pakistan, where people live on a dollar a day, and you have 50% illiteracy and a large number of warring tribes and religious sects. Whatever we do, we're going to come out with a chaotic mess. And the question is, will it be chaos that favors us or hurts us? If the Iranians exploit the chaos, get control of Iraqi and perhaps even Saudi oil reserves, and develop nuclear weapons, then we have a problem of an entirely different magnitude. If the Iranians have nuclear weapons, it means they can invade their neighbors under the threat of nuclear response should we go in and try to push them out. They become immune to the normal kind of deterrence. That's why I think the single most important policy issue for Republican candidates is to say clearly that they will do whatever is necessary, including as much use of force as is required to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
How can the Republicans, and I'm a conservative, but how can Republicans have any credibility when both Iraq and Afghanistan, which are two wars that started under our management, right? The whole nation went to war, but it was a Republican administration. Both wars are ending in military victories, or somewhat military, a total military victory in Iraq and a partial one in Afghanistan, but strategic defeat. How does the Republican Party have credibility to talk about taking the nation into another war?
Well, that's exactly the problem we've got, Steve, and that's why for the last 10 years I've stepped on a lot of toes in the Republican Party and made myself unpopular by saying we will lose credibility if we pursue a policy, spend $1 trillion of treasure, 4,000 lives, 40,000 wounded, the American people will have enough. I think what Republican candidates can do and what the American people will applaud is to say we're not going to have another nation-building exercise, another occupation army, but we will use American force, particularly from the air, subversion, and so forth, to stop Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. We don't have to invade them. We just have to decapitate their leadership.
Listen, I think the lesson, you know, Gaddafi and Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, the lesson is without nukes, at the end of the day, we'll get them. And so that's why I think it's very important that the mullahs in Iran not get nukes. And if the American leadership doesn't get that, then we're in deep trouble. With the few minutes we've got, David, the Spengler column, Asia Times Online, it's a must read. Talk to us about Panetta went from the meetings in Pakistan to Asia, and there's a new talk. We had Dr. Aaron Friedberg here 2 weeks ago with his new book, and he was named that date as Mitt Romney's advisor. The new military and new conference seems to me the new confrontational attitude in China or around China by the United States. How do you view that?
China can either be a friendly rival or an unfriendly rival. I don't believe China wants to replace us as the hegemonic power in the world. They've never shown that much interest outside areas related to their immediate border.
Right.
But when the United States undergoes a strategic withdrawal and announces that it's committing a strategic withdrawal, it's letting the world get into much more dangerous condition, and the Chinese, as a matter of self-interest, will try to move into the vacuum. Take Pakistan, for example. A lot of people are saying, oh, look at China, they're moving into Pakistan, they want to take the place over. If we don't coddle the Pakistanis, they'll fall into the hands of the Chinese. Not true. The Chinese are extremely worried about the Pakistanis because they've got 100 million Muslims in their country, and they have terrorists that are being trained by Pakistani intelligence, the same people who organized the attack on our embassy in Kabul a couple of months ago.
Yep.
Those
yep.
guys are also training terrorists who are operating yep. in China. The Chinese
a 24-hour attack that made the page 20 in the New York Times. Listen, David, we've got to go. We're going to have you back. My guest has been David
Thank
Goldman.
You very much.
He's got a must-read column, Spengler, in Asia Times Online, and also the author of the new book, How Civilizations Die, another great book from Regnery. So please pick it up. David Goldman, thank you very much for being on the Victory Sessions.
Thank you so much, Steve.